and gentlemen, welcome to Oral Presentations Podcast. This is episode 85, and it's called Out Here Looking for Clues, Agatha Christie's, and Then There Were None. What's up? Coming off vacation. We're back. It's the fall, pretty much. September, October's almost here. Cruising into Christmas, 2021. That's where we're at. How you doing? How was your, I hope your August was good. You know, mine was all right. I got pneumonia at the beginning of it, which is kind of why I took another break. That was the third time this year. So I went to the emergency room and they were like, yo, dude, what are you doing? How'd you get pneumonia a third time when you're 34, huh? I was like, I don't know, man. I don't know. Can you help me out? They put me on a bunch of medicine. And I had like 2 weeks where I had never had antibiotics that strong before. When I was young, I almost cut my own foot off with an ice skate, and I was on some pretty serious medication after that. But this is the strongest medicine I'd been on since then. It was unpleasant. I had to take it like twice a day, and at night. So at night, dude, more than one time when I was trying to go to sleep, like, it wasn't the spins. Like, if you've drank a little bit in your life, you know what the spins are, where, like, you know, things are spinning, you try to put a foot on the ground. This was like, I was the top of the, of like a pistol, like the Dostovoy from GoldenEye, when you shoot it and the thing kicks back and goes forward. That was the type of spins. It was like, I felt I was the top of a Dostovoy going back and forth. I remember being like, this is a totally useless form of messed up, dude. This shit better be working, because I'm laying in this bed feeling like the top of a gun going back and forth. This is insane. So that was all right. That was like the beginning of my August. And then I put a movie thread in the Patreon where I asked for movie recommendations, because Rainey from Dad Meat told me about this Nick Cage movie called Pig from this. I think it's from this year, where it's kind of like John Wick, but it's about a pig and it has a lot to do with fine dining. And I'd never even really seen what Portland as a city looked like. It was pretty great. So, I mean, that recommendation was so good that then I made a movie thread and just asked the Patreon, like, yo, I would love some movie recommendations. I'm kind of, like, dizzy some of the time on this medicine. Can you guys help me out? And then I got, like, a bunch of great movie recommendations, man. One specifically is called The Beast Must Die. It's from 1973. It's a movie, but it's also an activity, because the whole point of the thing, it's, like, a bunch of people at, like, a high-level swanky party, but one of them is a werewolf. And you don't know which one it is. So as you're watching the movie, the whole time, as the viewer, you got to be like, which one of these people is a werewolf? You know, and you try to suss it out. Some people get shot. Some people don't. Somebody, there's like a guy who used to eat people in Argentina who's one of them. You're like, is this that guy? And then he has a bow and arrow and he's running around. At some point in time, the guy in the house disables all the cars. And anyway, you got to guess what the werewolf is. There's even a werewolf break at the end of that movie. Like, right before somebody starts turning into a werewolf and the mystery is solved, they give you, like, a 30-second clock timer, like a graphic from Videotech in 2001 that you would just, like, slide up, and it looks like a PBS show from 1991 where they'd give you the breakdown, or, like, some sort of crappy graphic from the Weather Channel when I was young. But it's really fun, because then it shows you all the characters, and you're like, I don't know which one. I kind of stop paying attention to who's a werewolf. They all seem like they're going to be werewolves. And then you find out, so I'm not going to tell you which one was it. I got it wrong. I've recommended to a bunch of people in my life. I haven't had one person text me back and be like, I nailed it. I had somebody last night text me back and was like, I thought it was this guy. At first, I thought it was this one. Nobody's gotten it right yet. So, what a fun challenge, not doing anything. The only thing, it's like 90 minutes long. I don't know. It's kind of cheesy, like orchestra, like horn music from the 70s, like, beep, 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 beep. But it's fun to try to figure out who the werewolf is, right? So I spent time doing that over the break, and that's kind of where this topic comes from, because I guess I caught the mystery bug, and then this is the best-selling murder mystery novel in the world, Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None. It's also a popular book to read down the beach. Never really thought I would end up doing this in my life, but I did end up at the beach for like a couple of days with family, and then there's only so much to do at this point in time in my life down there, so, you know, it's time to curl up with a good murder mystery book. And I got to reading it, And it's actually pretty great. The first 25 pages are tough sledding. There's a lot of information. That's kind of how this episode's also going to be built, but it's all right. I blocked it out. You got to learn 10 main characters pretty quick, but it was a good read. The book itself, or the story, is 269 pages, which sounds like a lot, but once you get the main characters going, it's a murder mystery and it flies by. It's an easy read. And then at the end, there's an epilogue where it's mostly just the cops, apparently, looking around the mansion where everybody got killed in. They're like, I don't know what the hell happened here. And then at the end of the book, there's a short portion that tells you what happened. The solution of the murder mystery. Okay, I haven't read either of those last parts yet, on purpose. I've only read 1 to 269 because I wanted the story to be able to make these episodes while still not knowing the answer. Because I don't know, I thought that if I knew the answer, then I wouldn't even be able to control it when I would make the episodes. I would definitely lean into who was actually guilty, and I probably would just care less in general as far as getting details down. So I don't know what happens in this book. I know the story. And so we're doing it in multiple parts. This one is going to be, we're going to hit our 10 main characters, we're going to nail down setting, where's the house at, and then we're going to drop 3 bodies. So we're going to end up with 7 players left at the end of this one. RIP to 3 of them. Meet everybody. I think it might feel like a lot of information, but I think we can get it done in one episode and get all the way down to 7 players left. And then after that, with 7 left, I may chunk it again with another 3 bodies and then the 4 remaining. Or maybe we just do one big one at the end with the solution. But however it ends up getting chopped up, this whole topic, the book itself, it's all going to be made public, so no parts of this are going to be on the Patreon. It's just the topic's public, the pieces are going to be public. By the end of it, hopefully you'll be able to tell people that you know the story of Agatha Christie's and then there were none. So that's the point. That's what we're doing. That's the comeback episode. I'm pretty excited for it. I'm a little worried that I can't tell you guys all the characters and have you keep track of them, but as the story goes on, people start doing shit, it's way easier to keep track of. But 10 main characters in the first 25 pages of a book, if I didn't have in the back of my mind when I was reading this at the beach with like a box of fudge, Laura's fudge, ate a whole box of fudge reading a murder mystery. Chris, what happened? If I didn't think I was going to do this as an episode, I don't think I would have gone past page 25 because there's so many moving parts. I'd learned 10 main characters, and like if I was just reading for recreation, which never happens to begin with, but I certainly wouldn't keep going on a book that's like so much to keep track of in the first 30 pages. So I'm pretty psyched that I had a reason to keep going with the book. I think it would be a pretty good couple sets of episodes here. So anyway, here we go. All right, Agatha Christie's, and then there were none. Now the first 25 pages of the book, you do have to learn 10 main characters. We'll get to them in just a second. But before we even do that, we're just going to shotgun blast all these details. I made a list of the characters. We're just going to talk about the setting. We're not going to introduce it the way they do it in the book. This is just the first 30, 50 pages, whatever. All the information that gets thrown at you. So this is the stuff. And don't feel bad if you miss some of it. Again, the events of the story will reinforce who these people are. But we're just going to run down where it happens and who's doing shit right now. All right, so check it out. The actual story takes place on Soldier Island. This is a very petite island. It is off the coast of England. It's not a tropical island. Whenever I hear a story about an island, I think palm trees and island of Dr. Brain. It is not that type of island. It kind of looks like Ireland. Actually, the BBC made a series based on this book. So after I read the book, I then watched the BBC series that somebody pointed out to me and had the experience of being like a person who loves a murder mystery book, who watches it made into film, and then criticizes it for like, oh, no, that character does not, why did you make him have the breakdown? Also, that gun doesn't go on the bed. But it's well done. The BBC did a great job. It's on Amazon and stuff. So I read the book, watched the BBC thing, made notes after the thing. So I feel like I know this story pretty well. Anyway, so it takes place on Soldier Island. It's off the coast of Devon, England. The whole island kind of looks like Ireland. If you've seen postcards where like there's rocks and crags and long grass, and pretty much the only thing on the island is a giant mansion. Now they call it like a modern house in the book. And throughout the book, the characters are like, oh, I'm really happy all this creepy shit's happening in a modern house, because if it happened in like an old-timey house, that would be really scary. Okay, but the book was published in 1939, and you live in 2021 with me, and so a house from 1939 is still very much a haunted house to us. So even though in the book they're like, it's a modern house, it's not scary, there's no hidden passages, if we were to go into that house, all right, so if you want an example of it, because I looked at the architecture from 1939 once I thought of this, if you wanted to check out what this might have looked like in the author's mind, Google the Hotel Vancouver. It was built same year, 1939. You check that out with the god, like there's like gargoyles and shit on it. Again, that was a modern house for the time. But I looked up the other buildings in Hotel Vancouver and just assumed that the place looked like that. Also, in the BBC series, it definitely constitutes as a haunted house. I'm not sure when the architecture of Disney's Haunted Mansion is based upon, which I think for me is the gold medal of what a haunted house looks like. But I think this isn't too far off. It's kind of like Great Gatsby architecture, but I don't know. What was Gatsby, like the 20s? So like 1939, a little bit past that, a little bit farther than that. Anyway, brand new mansion, but still architecture for us would be creepy, I think. Anyway, so giant house on a small island off the coast of England. And when I say small island, like this thing's like the size of a par three. This is a very small island. The only thing on it's a house. You got a dock. The place was originally built by a millionaire whose third wife didn't like to sail or like got sick and just hated the ocean or something. So then that millionaire sold it off. And at the beginning of the book, there's sort of like rumors in the press of like, nobody knows who bought the mansion on Soldier Island. Like there's somebody, people think that somebody like a movie star bought it or something, but there's no proof to that. But all of our characters get invited by letter, I'm pretty sure by letter or telegram, by some dude or chick with the initials of U.N. Owen. U.N. Owen invites everybody. And we'll get to everybody in a second. But anyway, that's where the house came from. The only person that really goes to the island is a guy named Fred Narricott. He's like Quint from Jaws. He just lives like on the England side of this island. And then once a day at 8 a.m., he goes over to Soldier Island. He's like, yo, what's up? You need any Slim Jims or whatever? I'm running to Sev. You want something? That's pretty much Fred Narricott's role in this. When Fred was first introduced in the book, I thought I was on to something where I was like, it's definitely the boat guy. Nobody's going to suspect the boat guy. The boat guy, I mean, I don't know if it was the boat guy, but all he really does is shuttle our 10 main characters, or actually our 8 main characters, to meet our other 2 main characters onto the island. That's pretty much Fred Narricott's business. All right, so story takes place on a small island, par 3, with a giant mansion that was built like 1939, but the book says it's not scary, but it's definitely scary. Oh, also, house is 2 floors with an attic. The second floor of the house is just all bedrooms for the guests that are going to go there, and a couple of bathrooms. Everybody has their own room, pretty big house. Downstairs, everything else. Kitchen, drawing room, all the other shit we're going to talk about, where other conversations take place. There are some terraces that are on the top that people sit out on and they have conversations. Again, we're dealing with like a Great Gatsby mansion that the book says doesn't look haunted, but yeah, it would be haunted if we were hanging out there and people started getting killed. That place definitely would count as a haunted mansion, man. All right, so that's where our story's taking place. Who is in this book? All right. Character rundown, first 25-ish pages. Number 1, Mr. Rogers. Think Tim Curry from Clue here. This is the butler of the mansion on Soldier Island. He is a tall, lanky dude. He has a strong professional presence about him. And he is husband to his wife, who is also one of the characters. Next up, Mrs. Rogers. Now, Mrs. Rogers also works at the mansion on the house with Mr. Rogers. They are at the house when the other 8 main characters get there via Fred Narricott's boat tour. Now, Mrs. Rogers is described in the book as a nervous white ghost of a woman. Now, she's got a lot on her mind. It's said that she looks like she's frightened of her shadow. She is the wife of Mr. Rogers and the housekeeper at Soldier Island. So, for the picture I put next to this character description, if you've seen Parasite, The First Nanny is what I went with to try to make me remember this for Mrs. Rogers. The First Nanny from Parasite, who's allergic to peaches. And then they hit her with that peach fuzz, and then she starts having asthma attacks and gets fired, and the mom gets hired. So again, Mr. Rogers, Tim Curry from Clue, Mrs. Rogers, the First Nanny from Parasite, who's allergic to peaches. Next main character, Anthony Tony Marston. This dude is young, talking mid-20s. He is very popular with the ladies. He's living like a Fast and Furious life. He loves driving cars as fast as possible. He also likes drinking. He was informed by a letter from like an alleged friend who was in Norway or something that like, hey, you got to come to this house on Soldier Island on August 8th. It's going to be awesome. So the picture I chose for Anthony Tony Morrison is Tommy Morrison, the boxer from the early 90s, who was like a young sensational figure who fell on some hard times after his professional boxing career, but also will live on forever in that role he played where he fought Rocky in an alleyway in a street fight. I think that was like Rocky IV. At that point in time, they were taking chances in the script to try some new things. So anyway, that's Tony Morrison. Young kid, loves driving fast, drinking. He kind of shoots his mouth off a little bit. He sort of looks like a movie star. All right, next up, Mr. Bloor. This is a retired police officer. He's got a mustache, and he's still physically strong. Now, as Mr. Bloor is on the train going to the dock to get on Fred Narricott's boat, when we first meet Mr. Bloor, he has a list of the guests and is checking it on the train. He's the only one with a guest list of who he's about to meet here when he's going to go on Fred Narricott's boat to go on the murder mystery house. That nobody knows the murder mystery house, but it quickly turns into that. So Bloor's got a list, and he also decides privately to himself as he's going towards the dock to get on Narricott's boat when he's still on the train. Bloor thinks to himself, like, yo, nobody knows me here. I'm going to say my name is Mr. Davis, and I'm going to tell him that I'm from South Africa. That's what I'm going with. So Bloor assumes a false identity on the train to the boat to get to the house, and he knows he has all of them, he has a list of names of who's going to be there. Very suspicious as far as Bloor getting set up here. Oh, and if I haven't, I think I forgot to say this up front. One of these people or multiple of these people end up killing everybody else. I don't know which one it is. Again, I haven't read the end yet because I thought I would pay more attention to detail if I didn't know the answer in like making the actual story one. So I really don't know. So I'm just as in the dark as you on this one if you haven't read the book before. So Bloor's got a list on the way in. An ex-police officer, still physically strong, assumes a fake identity. All right, next up, main character, Vera Claythorne. This is a lady in her mid-20s. She just finished a semester at school, and she was contacted by an agency who goes and finds like high-level secretaries for rich people. Again, another Parasite tie-in here. So you remember that like the family in Parasite would just like, I think it was when the dad got hired, they said he was from a reputable agency to be a driver. Same kind of thing here where like an agency finds help for rich people. That's how Vera Claythorne gets invited to this party time. So, oh yeah, it's called a skilled woman's agency. That's what it's called in the book. Now, Vera's got a little bit of, she's got some thoughts going on in her head. She's kind of preoccupied because she is currently in love with a dude named Hugo. But because of circumstances we will learn about later in the book, that didn't work out. Also, she may have killed a kid. All right. Next up, Philip Lombard. Here we go, a.k.a. Captain Lombard. The picture I used for Vera Claythorne is Matt Damon's girlfriend from The Departed, Vera Farmiga, I think the name is that actress, or Vera Farmiga. It's the only other, I Googled Vera, and that was, you know, I was like, oh, yeah, she has the same name. Cool. So Vera Claythorne, think girlfriend of Matt Damon from The Departed. That's our character here. All right, next up. Sorry to backtrack. Philip Lombard. Now, the picture I went with this one is the boss Lumberg from Office Space. So that's the character I thought of the whole time I was reading this. He's also known as Captain Lombard. Now, Philip Lombard is an ex-military dude. He has worked as a mercenary. He's not wealthy, and he's done some illegal shit. Now, he gets invited to Soldier Island by a third party called Mr. Morris. Mr. Morris is like, hey, what's up? My client is at Soldier Island at this house. I can't really tell you too much. I'm going to pay you to go out there. When you get there, you got to service my client however he wants. And Lombard, in that meeting, is like, well, are we talking like illegal shit? Like, what are you talking about? And the guy, Mr. Morris, who's hiring him, is like, I can't even, I don't know, man. Why do you have to know about that? Like, I mean, you use your own judgment, whatever you got to do. So Lombard's like, all right, well, whatever. I'm broke as shit. I'll go. So that's Philip Lombard. Next up, General Mack. All right. Now, in the book, this is General MacArthur, but in more modern versions of the book, it's General Mackenzie, which I can only assume they changed because of World War II, because General MacArthur in World War II was a big deal. The same way that, like, if you wrote a book in 1939, had a main character named Beyonce, I think you would kind of have to change that name. I don't know if you'd have to. I honestly don't know why they changed the name. But I could see it that way, that if a main character was called Beyonce and then, like, you were reading it in 2021, you may have to change that to, like, Beatrice or something, just so the name itself isn't distracting. I don't really know why they renamed this guy. Anyway, General Mack, retired Army general. He's in his 50s, early 60s. He has a complicated romantic past, which we'll get into. His wife died of pneumonia a while back. He's pretty lonely. And his friends don't talk to him anymore. So he gets invited to the island by UN Owen in a letter that says, like, hey, some of your old cronies are going to be here. Come hang out, man. So that's General Mack. Kind of down on his luck, I used a picture of Ben Stiller from Tropic Thunder for General Mack. Next up, Miss Emily Brent. All right, this is an older lady. This character is pretty much like crabby Mary Poppins. And that's the picture I used. I used an actress, Emily Blunt, which I only knew her name. I didn't really know what she did or anything, but that's like one of the few celebrities I know their name. So I looked up what she did. That's the wife of the guy off The Office, Jim. And so Emily Blunt was the lady who was in that time travel movie with Tom Cruise where they were fighting aliens or something. Anyway, she also played Mary Poppins at some point in time. So I just used a picture of Emily Blunt as Mary Poppins for this character. Now the character, Emily Brent, older lady, she doesn't like gramophones or cushions on seats. She's big on reading the Bible. And she was invited by a personal letter from just the initials UNO. And the letter said that, like, hey, I remember meeting you on vacation a couple years ago. I liked how, like, I don't know, restrained and how you hate gramophones. How about you come to this island on August 8th? We're going to have a party. No gramophones, just old style. No cushions on seats. I know you're going to love it. So Miss Emily Brent is coming for a free vacation, more or less, and she doesn't know who invited her. So that's Emily Brent, Emily Blunt, Crabby Mary Poppins, one of our 10 main characters. Next up, Judge Wargrave. This is a retired judge. I used a picture of the judge from Ghostbusters 2 for this, and the book describes him as looking like a turtle, like, more than three times. So this is a turtle-looking retired judge. He does have false teeth, because at one point in time before he goes to bed, he takes his teeth out. He was invited to Soldier Island by an old friend, Constance Covington, which more or less just said, like, hey, Judge, what's up? I haven't seen you in forever. Why don't you come hang out? I'd love to see you. And it was in the same tone of Constance Covington. So actually, when the judge first gets to the murder palace on the island, the judge is like, yo, do you know Constance Covington? And everybody's like, dude, we have no idea what the hell you're talking about. But that's a little bit further on. And our last of our 10 main characters is Doc Armstrong. This is a successful London doctor. He was skilled, but also lucky. He nailed a few diagnoses on really rich ladies, like pretty early into his private practice. And then from word of mouth, his private practice expanded and expanded and expanded. So this guy's making money. He also almost ruined his life drinking like 10 to 15 years ago. We'll find out more about that later. The picture I used for Doc Armstrong, Christopher Lloyd from Back to the Future, Doc Brown. And those are our 10 main characters, guys. Don't worry if you didn't pick it up. Again, the story's all about them, so we'll recap it as we go through here. Anyway, let's get going. Let's get these people on the island, get some bodies dropping. Here we go. All right, our group of eight assemble at a place called Sickle Barn? Sicklehorn? Not important. It's just where Fred and Aricott's boat dock is. And this is our primary group of eight main characters. They will go on to meet Mr. and Mrs. Rogers in the mansion in just a sec. Now, just to recap, who are eight main characters that are all about to hop on this boat with Fred. We got Anthony, Tony Marston, a.k.a. Tommy Morrison. You got Mr. Bloor, the retired police officer with a mustache who's still strong, and he has a list of everybody. You got Vera Claythorne, mid-20s, just finished a semester. It's the girlfriend from The Departed, Matt Damon's girlfriend, who wears a Harvard shirt. Same name, Vera. That's who that is. You got Philip Lombard, who is Lumberg from Office Space. This dude is sort of a weird mercenary who got paid to just kind of show up. He doesn't know if illegal shit's going to happen or not. You got General Mack, retired Army general. Got complicated romantic past on him. You know, he's working through it. Don't really talk to his friends anymore. He's probably psyched to go out there. He was lured there by, like, the letter said, yeah, you got some old friends here, man. You want to come hang out? So he's like, yes, I would like that. I miss my wife quite a bit. You also got Miss Emily Brent, a.k.a. Krabby Mary Poppins. Hates cushions on seats. You got Judge Wargrave, the judge from Ghostbusters 2. Book calls him a turtle, like, more than three times. He's also got false teeth. Then you got Doc Armstrong, medical doctor from London. I use Doc Brown from Back to the Future because that's the most recognizable doctor I know of as far as film goes to help me keep track of that. So that's our eight people. They're about to get on this boat with Fred Narricott, a.k.a. Quinn from Jaws. And they all meet up at Sicklehorn. Now, they're all quietish. They're all strangers to one another. So Fred Narricott's like, hey, what's up, guys? Get on my boat. Let's go. Tour time. Now, Anthony Tony Marston wasn't there to begin with, but he gets there just as the boat is leaving. Like, as people are about to get on Fred Narricott's boat, the young guy, there's like the young, good-looking Hollywood guy, a.k.a. Tommy Morrison. He drives down fast as shit in this, like, delicious-looking car. And it's a moment in the book where everybody looks and sees this guy come over, and they're like, oh, my God, who is this? And then he gets out, like Vin Diesel, and he's like, what's up? I'm here to get on the boat, right? It's supposed to be, like, an important entrance as far as the formula character goes, I think. I don't know. Again, I don't know who's killing everybody. It might be this guy. I don't know. Anyway, so all eight of them, boat set sail for Soldier Island. Toot, toot. Here we go. Now, en route, Fred Narricott, who's taken people to this house before for, like, different parties and stuff, and he knows that a millionaire owns the mansion. There's a part of the book where Fred Narricott's eyeing up this group, and he's like, these people kind of look like shit. You know, for, like, a millionaire party, these people all kind of look like trash, you know? I mean, there's, like, I would expect it more for a millionaire party, with the exception of Tony Marston, the guy who just peeled out and got out of a Lambo with, like, the, well, I guess, like, a 1939 Lambo. With, like, the suicide doors on it or whatever the hell was going on there. So, Fred Narricott's like, with the exception of this guy who loves drinking and driving fast, the rest of these people kind of look like bums, dude. So, all eight of our players arrive at the house. Here we go, right? So, as they go into the house, we meet our ninth player, Mr. Rogers, a.k.a. Tim Curry from Clue. He's the house butler. Again, tall, lanky dude. And the people in the group who are kind of trepidatious about going here, because it's already like, I'm with all these strangers, we got to take a boat, I don't know how the hell I'm getting out of here, I'm already off-put by this whole lack of control of this situation. When they meet Mr. Rogers, a number of them are like, well, at least this guy knows what the hell he's doing. All right, this can't be so bad, that's fine. So we meet Mr. Rogers. Nice, everybody gets shown to their bedroom. Hey, everybody's got their own room, it's pretty sick. So, Mr. Rogers then says, hey, just real quick, the guy who invited you here, Mr. Owens or Mrs. Owens, whoever invited you here, they sent a telegram, they're not going to be here. It's just going to be you guys partying down tonight. When our hosts get here, we may kick it off. I don't know what we're going to be doing, set up a slip and slide. I have no idea what's planned. Anyway, he just left me instructions, and he said this morning that, like, he's not going to be here. So, it's just us hanging out tonight. Not a big deal. Tony Marston immediately is like, all right, cool, I'm going to fucking party, dude. So this guy goes and he starts just cracking open bourbon and tying one on. He doesn't have a car on the island, so this guy, it's party time for this dude. We then meet our 10th and final player, Mrs. Rogers, wife of Mr. Rogers. They're like a duo who run the house. And this is when she gets called a nervous white ghost of a woman and frightened of her own shadow by Vera Claythorne, which is the conversation that we get introduced to Mrs. Rogers because Vera's up in her room just figuring things out, how's she going to sleep, set her stuff up. Mrs. Rogers is like, hey, what's up, I'm Mrs. Rogers. And Vera, in her head, is like, this lady looks scared of everything, dude. Jesus, right? Anyway, but that rounds it out. Those are our 10 players. That's everybody, right? All right. We then find out that Mr. and Mrs. Rogers have never met Mr. Owens or Mrs. Owens or anybody with Owens. Nobody's met any of these people. The butler and his wife were just left instructions of like, yo, you got this many people coming, you're doing this. And then they got a separate telegram that was like, by the way, we're going to be late. So whatever, you want to slip and slide by yourselves tonight, that's fine. We'll be there tomorrow. But we find out that nobody has met these people who are allegedly hosting this mansion party. In the conversation between Vera and Mrs. Rogers before that part of the book is done, we also learn that everybody's room, all of our players who are staying there, they all have the same poem posted in their room somewhere. And so I just ripped a page out of the book because this poem's actually pretty important to the structure of the book. And just in case you have to, like, if you're listening to this because you have to, like, be in a class where they're going to talk about this book and you don't feel like reading it, or if you got, yeah, I actually kind of, the poem's pretty important to the book. So I just tore the page out and taped it to the bottom of the notes. So check this out as I read you poetry on oral presentations. All right, so in every room, this poem is posted. 10 little soldier boys went out to dine. One choked his little self, and then there were 9. 9 little soldier boys sat up very late. One overslept himself, and then there were 8. 8 little soldier boys traveling in Devon. One said he'd stay there, and then there were 7. 7 little soldier boys chopping up sticks. One chopped himself in halves, and then there were 6. 6 little soldier boys playing with a hive. A bumblebee stung one, and then there were 5. 5 little soldier boys going in for law. One got into chancery, and then there were 4. I don't know if I said that word right. 4 little soldier boys going out to sea. A red herring swallowed one, and then there were 3. 3 little soldier boys walking in the zoo. A big bear hugged one, and then there were 2. 2 little soldier boys sitting in the sun. One got frizzled up, and then there were 1. There was 1. 1 little soldier boy left all alone. He went and hanged himself, and then there were none. That's an actual poem by Frank Green from 1869. And it's all over the inside of this book. It's a huge reference point that the story keeps coming back to. But for our purposes, if you were one of these people who got to this mansion party that you got invited to by an anonymous person, your room has a copy of this poem posted where if you ever stayed in a hotel and they got the fire exit, how to get out of here if the whole thing catches on fire, right on the back of the door, that's where this strange poem about soldier boys getting killed in all sorts of ways, and then the last one hangs himself. Every room has one of those in there. So, you know, maybe you got some sort of reservations of what's supposed to be planned this week. That's a strange thing for a host to do. I don't think they came with the house. But anyway, the poem's important to the book. So we meet that, or we discover that when Vera is figuring out that Mrs. Rogers is a nice lady, but pretty much nervous all the time. And then we find out the Rogers, nobody's ever met the Owens. So then Doc Armstrong and Wargrave are kind of hanging out. Everybody's kind of mulling around. It's not dinner time yet, but it's close. So right before dinner, Doc Armstrong and Judge Wargrave have sort of a side conversation. Like, hey, have I seen you? And Doc Armstrong's like, I don't know if you'd seen me. Maybe, I'm not sure. Maybe I gave evidence or something. I'm not really sure if I know you. And the judge is like, nah, I'd remember. I don't know, it's sort of like a weird side conversation. I don't know if they're sizing each other up or what, but that happens before the book and like before dinner, and they're kind of looking at each other like, I'm not sure. Do you know me? Do I know you? Whatever. Anyway, all right, dinner time, 8:00. What's established at dinner as everybody's talking around each other with no host is that everybody's got that strange poem in the room, and then they take a look at the center of the dining table, and there are 10 army men, like Sarge's heroes, look at army men in the middle of the table. It's supposed to like correlate with the poems that it's in everybody's room. The idea of 10 little soldier boys. Again, important for the book as we move forward. But as they're at dinner, they're like, ah, that's kind of fun. I don't know. Maybe the guy really likes the poem. Maybe he knew the guy who wrote the poem. That's kind of strange, but whatever. And then it's also established that nobody at the dinner table or in the house has ever met anybody named Owen. All right. It's almost at the end of dinner. It's like coffee time. We're done eating. We're done everything. It's just having some nice coffee. It was a nice dinner. All right, 8:45 p.m. A voice booms. It sounds like it's in another room. It is not. It's not. It sounds like it's in the room, but it's actually in another room. Okay, huge voice, right? This is the second page of the book that I just ripped out and taped onto the bottom of the notes because this is pretty important too. All right, so after the dinner, voice comes out of nowhere and it says, "Emily Caroline Brent, that upon the 5th of November, 1931, you are responsible for the death of Beatrice Taylor. William Henry Bloor, that you brought about the death of James Stephen Landor on October 10th, 1928. Vera Elizabeth Claythorne, that on the 11th day of August, 1935, you killed Cyril Ogiliv Hamilton. Philip Lombard, that upon the date in February 1932, you were guilty of the death of 21 men, members of the East Africa tribe. Judge Gordon MacArthur, John Gordon MacArthur, which is General Mac for our purposes. That on the 4th of January 1917, you deliberately sent your wife's lover, Arthur Richmond, to his death. Anthony James Marston. That upon the 14th day of November last, you were guilty of the murder of John and Lucy Combs. Thomas Rogers and Ethel Rogers, that's Mr. and Mrs. Rogers. That on the 6th of May, 1929, you brought about the death of Jennifer Brady. Judge Lawrence John Wargrave, a.k.a. Judge Wargrave. That upon the 10th day of June, 1930, you were guilty of the murder of Edward Seaton. Prisoners at the bar, have you anything to say for your in your defense? Okay, so that pretty much ruins dinner. So much so that Mrs. Rogers then almost immediately faints, dude. She got TKO'd by a voice. That's it. The lady was nervous all the time. She got dropped, dude. She's out. Get the salts, dude. Get the salts. She's done, right? Scary voice by KO. So, Lombard, Tony Marston, and Doc Armstrong then put Mrs. Rogers in the drawing room with some brandy, which throughout the book, brandy is just used as medicine. So they get her some brandy and they're like, she's fine. Just get her, just drink some of this. She passed out. What the hell was that ghost voice? I'm not sure. It also accused all of us of murder, which I don't really want to talk about right now, but that was kind of strange. But let's get this lady some brandy. She needs some medicine. Come on. So everybody is freaked out except for Judge Wargrave and Miss Emily Brent. So except for the judge, the turtle judge from Ghostbusters 2 and Krabby Mary Poppins, everybody else is pretty freaked out right now. Lombard then goes into another room and discovers a gramophone through like the wall that goes into the dining room. And then somebody has drilled holes that you couldn't notice because of like the ornate wallpaper. That, again, you're going to act like this isn't a haunted house, dude. This is a haunted house. You got wallpaper that can hide holes in it. Lombard discovers a gramophone with a record on, and then he discovers that that record is what all the accusations of murder was. So immediately, people are like, what the fuck is it? Who put the record on, dude? What are we doing? So then Mr. Rogers is like, hey, here's the thing. Remember how I got instructions from Mr. Owen about you guys coming? Well, putting that record on the gramophone through the secret wall was just a direction that I got. I'll show you the letter. It just says put this on, it'll be nice. You know, I thought it was like a Sting album or something, just something kind of relaxed, like I dream of rain. I thought it was like a nice thing. It turns out it's murder accusation. Sorry about that. And then Rogers produces the letter from Owens that says, you know, put this record on. So Rogers put the record on, but didn't know what it was. So we're kind of putting the pieces together a little bit. Now, Mrs. Rogers is still pretty banged up from Ghost Voice. It was a good shock. She went all the way out, dude. So then they take her upstairs to her room, and then Doc Armstrong gives her a mild sedative just to put her down, just to be like, I think it's bedtime for her. You know, she's had a lot. She seems like she's always got a lot on her mind, and I'll just give her some Trazodone or whatever the hell this is, and we'll just go ahead and put her down, okay? Mrs. Rogers had a big night. Mr. Rogers is like, it's fine, right? So they put Mrs. Rogers up in the room. Now, after Mrs. Rogers is up in the room, they figured out it was a gramophone. They also figured out that Rodgers put it on, but it wasn't his fault. It was just part of his job that he was told to do. He didn't know what the hell he was doing. Judge Wargrave huddles everybody up. And then they swap information, how they all got there. I got this letter, I got that letter, I got this. And then they just kind of like pass information amongst each other. Nothing too crazy happens, except for they ask Mr. Bloor, who is the undercover police officer with the mustache who's still physically strong, and he had a list as he was going to the place, right? Okay, well, the gramophone, it didn't say Mr. Davis. Remember on the train when Bloor was getting there, he was like, I'm going to have a little fun with this. I'm going to say my name is Mr. Davis and that I'm from South Africa and these people aren't going to know shit. Well, Phantom Gramophone kind of ruined that. So this is a tough first impression for Mr. Bloor for all the other party members, because the judge is like, okay, so who, Mr. Davis. So your name wasn't, it's funny that they didn't say Davis, but they did say Bloor. You got anything to say for that? And so Mr. Bloor is like, hey, my bad on that. I am not from South Africa. I was just having some fun. You ever be insecure about telling people who you really are? You know, I was having some fun. Sorry about that. I definitely lied to everybody's face here. I was hired as a private detective for Mr. Owen. He just said to come here, chill out, have a good time, but watch out if any creepy shit happens, you know? So I just picked a fake name because it's 1939. We're having fun out here. I didn't want to tell you people who the hell I was. After that tough first impression, now there's no Mr. Davis anymore. Everybody knows Bloor is Bloor now. Judge Wargrave then deduces that UN Owen, because it was like Olna Nancy Owen or just UN Owen, Judge Wargrave puts it together and then he's like, oh, dude, I think this actually means the word unknown. I think we all got tricked into coming here. I think there is no Mr. Owen or Mrs. Owen or anything. We totally got tricked. I don't know why the hell we're here, but I think this actually means unknown, guys. And everybody's like, oh my God, we did get tricked, dude. How about that? And then the judge is also like, by the way, I didn't kill that guy that the gramophone said I killed. I just want to put that out there. I did not kill that guy. I don't know what that gramophone record was talking about. After that, Vera... Claythorne decides to speak after the judge was like, I didn't kill that guy. Vera's like, oh, hey, what's up? I'm Vera. So that gramophone said I killed a kid. I did not kill a kid. I'm telling you, I was the nanny. The kid went out swimming. And he did drown. I did try to swim out and get him. He did die, you know. But that's what the gramophone was talking about there. I think that's pretty messed up that somebody would even put that on a record for me, to be honest with you. I was totally cleared by the coroner. That's like her chief evidence of like, no, I was watching a kid. He went out swimming. I couldn't save him. Cleared by the coroner, baby. Stop. I can't believe somebody would even say that about me. After that, General Mack is like, Vera, I don't even know why somebody would even say that to you. Honestly, I totally believe you. Also, as far as talking about who's innocent in this room, let me just say, General Mack, innocent. I don't know what they were talking about. War's crazy. I'm not sure what happened. That guy was a guy that I was commanding, and he did not make it. But that gramophone saying I killed him, that's not right. That's not true. And then after those three people saying that they're innocent, Philip Lombard steps up, and he's like, hey, guys, I know that's pretty great you're all innocent, but here's the thing. I definitely killed those 20 dudes. I did it. I was working as a mercenary, and we were in some, you know, how it goes when you're a mercenary. And then it was like me and 20 dudes, and I was just like, you know, I gotta take a walk. This is going poorly. So I left them to die. If you want to say I killed those 20 guys, I mean, it's a little uncouth, but I mean, it's not like it's untrue. And then Lombard's like, but another thing, like, I don't know. It wasn't even really like that. Those guys definitely got killed. Yeah, I did it. It's fine. After that, Tommy Marston, the guy who loves drinking and driving really fast, is like, well, if Lombard's coming clean about it, here's another thing. I killed those two kids. They were kids, dude. I hit them with my car. I was going so fast. I hit them both. And I got my license taken away for 6 months. It was pretty inconvenient, you know, but these things happen. And that's how Toni Morrison actually frames it, is like, it was inconvenient, you know. And then somebody's like, what do you mean inconvenient? For who, dude? You, the parents, the kids you killed, or you? He's like, I guess all around. I mean, nobody's happy that happened, you know. And then after that, Mr. Rogers details that, like, okay, the accusations leveled against me and my wife, the name that was said from that gramophone, that's our former employer. Now, she is dead, okay? And she did die while we were working for her, but she also had a heart condition. I'm just saying, guys, I know the gramophone said I killed that lady. I can't tell you if I did or not, but what we were working there. She had a heart condition. You had to give her medicine every day. Things happen. She died, okay? And then somebody asked Rogers, like, okay, but did she leave you any money or anything? And he was like, yeah, I mean, we had been working for her for a while, so she did give us some money. But it's not like that. She had health problems and she died, okay? After that, Mr. Bloor is like, well, as far as my accusation goes, that name that the gramophone said about me, that's just a dude. I arrested him, and then he got sentenced to a labor camp, and then he died. He died doing that. You know, he wouldn't. People speculated that, like, the person that I arrested shouldn't have gone to a labor camp, and that it was, like, hard punishment, and that he would never make it, and he's going to die out there, but, you know, that's what happened with me. Also, I got a promotion off that, not saying anything about it. I'm trying to tell you the whole truth and nothing but the truth, guys. But yeah, I arrested a guy. He died in a labor camp, and I got a promotion. So I don't know what the hell that gramophone's talking about. To which Doc Armstrong is like, yeah, I don't even know who that name was that the gramophone said. So I'm totally innocent. I don't even remember ever even meeting somebody like that, name that. I have no idea. Well, secretly, Armstrong privately knows it. Like, he did kill that lady that the gramophone said he killed. Because remember in the character introduction of Armstrong, like, 10, 15 years ago, he almost, like, ruined his life drinking too much. Wow, he killed that lady. He was doing surgery, and he was blacked out. And he said in the book that, like, the only person that knew about it was, like, the sister nun who was assisting him. So he kind of can't believe somebody would even find out about this shit. He's like, how the fuck? But publicly, as far as the party goes, he's like, I've never even heard that name. I'm a doctor. I'm doing the best I can out here. I don't even know what that gramophone's talking about, dude. And then finally, Emily Brent, Miss Emily Brent, Krabby Mary Poppins. Everybody's kind of looking at her to chime in here if we're talking about whether or not we're guilty. And she's just like, I really have nothing to say about that. Huh. All right, so then the whole group, after that conversation, comes to the conclusion that, like, we should probably just get the hell out of here. Whether or not we know what's going on, tomorrow morning we should leave when Fred Narricott shows up, okay? It's not that I don't like you guys. It's just that this is not working out, okay? A lady fainted, gramophone's saying we're all murderers. I don't know, that guy Lombard doesn't even seem like he's affected by it. He definitely killed 20 guys. I don't really want to hang out with him anymore. Let's just leave tomorrow morning. To which Toni Morrison, the guy who loves driving fast and drinking hard, he's the only one in the group who's like, I don't know. What else are we doing, you know? Let's figure this out. We could stick around, figure this shit out. It would be kind of fun. And to which Judge Wargrave is like, son, at my age, I'm not looking for thrills, okay? We should all get the hell off this island, all right? And Toni Morrison is like, what are you talking about? I'm staying. I'm going to figure it out. Here we go. And he's been banging down drinks all night. Toni Morrison, after he rebukes the judge, is like, I'm staying, dude. I'm going to figure it out. Slams down a brandy and then promptly chokes to death. Face turns purple. Collapses. Our first body. Toni Morrison. TKO'd. Poisoned. All right, so that's the first guy who dies, dude. See ya. And Armstrong checks to make sure that this guy is dead. Like, face purple. He got poisoned by somebody. Armstrong confirms that Toni Morrison is all the way dead, dude. Also, that it was an unnatural death. In Armstrong's opinion, he was poisoned and was probably potassium cyanide. the question of suicide comes up, but nobody in the room believes that it's suicide. They're like, what are you talking about? That guy was down to party as soon as he got here. He doesn't seem like a guy who's kind of bothered by a lot of shit. He seems like he was young and having fun. Also, remember him pull over the... Remember when he came to the boat in that car? It was all fast. This guy doesn't want to kill himself. Somebody killed this guy. But then they trace it back and they're like, well, he served himself, but we weren't watching his glass. Somebody could have spiked the actual glass itself. And then when he refilled his own bourbon, that was the drink that took him out. And then they figure out that everybody in that house could have had access to Tony Morrison's glass because nobody was watching anything. And it was by an open window, so somebody could have snuck outside, spiked it. Tony refills it, slugs it down after arguing with the judge, dead on the floor. That's our first body, Tony Morrison. He's out. They bring his body up to his room, cover him with a sheet. That's it. All right, 9 players left. End of day one, right around midnight. Emily Brent calls bedtime for everybody. She's like, I'm going upstairs. I'm locking myself in. I think you guys should do the same. Everybody follows her suit. They go upstairs. They lock themselves in the room in their own separate respective rooms. Now, before they go to bed, we get a couple of inner thoughts from the characters. The judge is thinking about hanging that dude Seton that the gramophone said that he killed. The judge doesn't really seem remorseless about it. He's just like, yeah, I don't know. I killed that guy, dude. I think the phrase cooked his goose is used in the book. The judge really doesn't feel bad about it. Oh, and Mr. Rogers is the last one to go upstairs. He has to stay downstairs and kind of clean up a little bit because, like, his wife's still, like, passed out upstairs. So he's kind of cleaning up by himself. And then he notices as he walks by the dining room table, only 9 little soldier boys left there. And Tony Morrison got TKO'd by poison. So there were 10 at dinner. Tony chokes out. Now there's only 9 left at the dinner table. If you have to keep up in conversation in any sort of, like, class setting, that'll probably be a big deal. That they'll talk about how, like, the soldiers on the table correspond with the murders in the house, which also has something to do with the poems in everybody's room where the fire escape direction should be. All right. Alone thoughts after they just saw a young guy die before they go to sleep. General Mack is thinking about how he definitely killed that guy. The guy that the gramophone said that General Mack killed. Now, he lied to the group when it was time for confessions of, like, did we do it? Did we not do it? General Mack privately in his room knows that he killed the guy, and here's how he did it, right? So General Mack, World War I, he had that dude underneath him, and then his wife, who he loved dearly, he like, General Mack throughout the book is like, I love my wife. I was proud of my wife. Well, wife sent him the wrong letter. The mail got mixed up. So, like, the wife sent him the letter that she intended for the soldier who was under his command, who she was secretly carrying on an affair with. Oh, no. So General Mack opens his mail from his babe while he's at war, and it's a letter intended for the guy underneath him who's secretly been sleeping with his wife for a while, it says in the book, that, like, it's been going on for a minute where, like, there's references of, like, when my husband comes home and all this other shit. So General Mack, in World War I, that happens to him. And then the guy is like, hey, what are we doing, man? So General Mack's like, oh, actually, I got a special mission for you. I got a really special mission for you, man. And then General Mack sends him on some sort of crazy World War I mission where he dies. There's, like, a 0% or, like, a 2% probability this dude was going to come back from this mission. So General Mack did, in fact, kind of kill this guy. I mean, he definitely killed this guy by sending him on a mission where, you know, he was going to end up dead. Now, his wife never found out about it directly. General Mack says that there was one other soldier in the war who kind of saw this whole thing happen. His name was Armitage. And he don't know if Armitage knew or didn't know or had a suspicion about it and maybe started a rumor that he sent this dude to his death. But technically, the wife never found out that General Mack sent this dude on a super dangerous mission to get killed, or that there was any sort of, that General Mack knew it all, that she was carrying on this affair or anything. And then after the war, when General Mack went home, his wife was, like, super distant, but they never talked about it or anything. The general wasn't like, yo, I know you were sleeping with that guy, you know, right? They never had that conversation at all. they just kind of lived in like a weird sort of distant relationship. And then she caught double pneumonia a couple years later and she passed away. So General Max thinking about all that shit. That's what the gramophone was talking about. And General Max there like, dude, I have no idea how anybody would have found that out. Armitage was the only guy who even had any sort of inkling at all that that would be going on. I thought, and secretly in General Max's head, part of the reason that he feels like he doesn't talk to his friends anymore is because maybe Armitage and that rumor got out, you know? And so whether or not that actually happened, General Mac does blame himself for his friends no longer really being close to him anymore because he thinks that there might be like a vicious rumor out there that he killed that guy who was sleeping with his wife. So General Max, he's going through it up in his head, locked in his door. You know, he's just trying to go to sleep. The death poem is still on the door. He's just like, oh, I got a lot going on. You know, I got a lot to think about. Now, bedtime thoughts for Vera Claythorne. She is thinking about this dude named Hugo. Now, she was a nanny for that kid, Cyril, who did swim out and drown. And she did swim out and try to save him. Okay, here's the real story of what happened there. Vera definitely killed that kid. Okay, so Hugo was like an uncle of the little boy Cyril that Vera was watching, right? And Hugo is like a young, good-looking dude, but he's poor. But he's in like the same family, so Hugo was in line for a huge inheritance, right? And Hugo was already in love with Vera. They were kind of like hanging out. He was like a romantic, allegedly, and then, but like, his family was like, you got to find somebody with money because, like, now that Cyril's around, you're not going to get any inheritance. You really got to, like, go out and find a rich lady. And I'm sure you wouldn't have problems with it. Apparently, Hugo was, like, a good-looking young dude or whatever. But him and Vera were, like, sort of dating on the sneak, right? But Vera knew the situation, too, where, like, the whole family wants Hugo to marry a rich lady. And Vera, student, nanny, not doesn't qualify as what the family was looking for. But she does watch Cyril. So Cyril was like, I want to go swim out to the rocks. I want to go swim out to the rocks. And so she finally told him, like, yeah, you can go swim out to the rocks. It's fine. And so in her head, she was like, well, if he comes back, I'll just yell at him and say I never told you to swim out to the rocks. And the only person that would know that I'm lying would be Cyril. And he's like a little boy, so who cares? Or if he swims out to the rocks and he dies, all of a sudden, Hugo gets that inheritance, and then my future with Hugo is looking awesome. So that's actually what happened as far as Vera killing that kid goes. She was like, yeah, go swim out, figure it out. And in the book, they say that the little boy Cyril was not like a young athletic boy. Like, she probably could have, you know, she made an educated guess on, like, you know, if he dies, then Hugo gets rich, and then we live together, you know what I'm saying? But after it happened, Hugo kind of looked at her like, what the hell, man? Like, what, yo, did you, there was some, Hugo didn't feel right about it. And then things kind of fell apart, and now Vera's alone. But she did get cleared by the coroner, who was like, there was no wrongdoing here or anything. But she's no longer in contact with Hugo, but she's still desperately in love with Hugo. So that's what Vera's thinking about it. She's locked in. She watched Toni Morrison die. That gramophone said she killed a kid. She said, I didn't kill a kid, but privately in her bedroom, she's like, damn, dude, I did kill that kid. Also, I'm still in love with Hugo. I totally botched that, dude. Shit. And then as far as nighttime thoughts go, Doc Armstrong's the last one. He has a nightmare of killing that lady on the operating table when he was hammered. But the lady in the dream has the face of Emily Brent. I don't know if that's a clue or what that means or anything. I don't really know. I honestly haven't even really formulated an educated guess at who's doing all this. I've just been thinking about the story, but now that I'm going through it, I'm like, was I supposed to pick up on shit to solve this mystery? Because I have not. I'm just going to read the end of the book in a couple of days and figure out what happened, but I really don't have an educated guess at who's doing this. But yeah, Armstrong dreams about killing that lady on the operating table, but it's got Krabby Mary Poppins' face. And that's the end of day one. All right. Morning of day two. Here we go. Armstrong, you know, twisting and turning with a nightmare. He is woken up by Mr. Rogers, the butler. Mr. Rogers is like, yo, dude, you gotta come here real quick. Can you please take a look at my wife? Doc Armstrong goes with Mr. Rogers into the room where they put Mrs. Rogers after she fainted after the gramophone. Doc Rogers looks at her and confirms Mrs. Rogers has died in her sleep. That is body number two. Mrs. Rogers, you're out. That's it. Leaving eight remaining players. She is done. She died in her sleep. Now, the room is searched. No drugs are found. And then Doc Armstrong does admit to Rogers, like, hey, man, look, I gave her, like, a mild sedative last night. I didn't kill her, dude. I don't know what any of this is, but I did give her a small sedative. Did she have health problems? And Rogers is like, yeah, I mean, we don't go to doctors or anything, but she shouldn't be dying in her sleep is weird, especially when you put together last night that guy dying from the drink. I mean, this is definitely strange, man. Also, I'm pretty sad. My wife's died, dude. Did you kill her? And Armstrong's like, I didn't kill her, bro. All right, so while this is going on, Mr. Bloor and Philip Lombard have woken up early, and they're out looking, waiting for Fred Narricott's boat, because these two dudes still got the eye on the prize of getting the hell off this par three before anybody else gets murdered. There's no boat. They're waiting, no boat. It's supposed to be 8 a.m. They say that things are kind of late around there because it's like a sleepy town. Nope, no boat. Nobody's coming for them. That sucks. So, the gong rings for morning breakfast, which, by the way, this is also in the BBC series. The way that they call people for meals is a giant gong in the foyer. They just boom, beat that thing. So I thought that was pretty cool. So the gong rings, 9 a.m., breakfast on day two. Mr. Rogers, even with his wife dying overnight, has prepared tea, coffee, and eggs for everybody. Now, before they eat, people are like, hey, where's Mrs. Rogers? And Dr. Armstrong is like, I think we should eat first. Let's eat first, and then we'll talk about where Mrs. Rogers is at, okay? So they all have, you know, tea, coffee, and eggs. And then afterwards, Armstrong announces that Mrs. Rogers has died in her sleep. To which Krabby Mary Poppins, a.k.a. Miss Emily Brent, is like, I bet guilt killed her. You know, that gramophone said that she killed that guy, and she died in her sleep from guilt. And then Mr. Bloor tells Miss Emily Brent, just like, yo, can you shut up? Can you please be quiet? Like, Rogers isn't in the room right now. He's in the kitchen, but, like, these, you know, some of these walls got holes in them, okay? Can you please shut up? You have no evidence for that, lady. So after that, Bloor is like, oh, by the way, let me just say this a little bit lower because Rogers isn't in this room. I think Rogers killed his wife, okay? I'm not saying this loud because I don't want to hurt his feelings, obviously, but I think he killed his own wife, dude. If I had to guess, I think Rog did it. To which General MacArthur cuts through and he's like, a man wouldn't do that to his wife. Like, General MacArthur's really having a hard time with his memories and shit. So at Bloor, you know, saying that a guy might have killed his own wife, General MacArthur kind of spazzes a little bit because he's got all that stuff in his head going from the war and his wife and how he ruined things. You know, I feel like General Mac gets overwhelmed pretty early in this book here. And then the conversation is cut short because Butler Mr. Rogers enters the room and nobody wants to keep talking about that shit with this guy here. So the conversation just turns into sort of a hush. All right. Ending breakfast conversation, now that Mr. Rogers is here and we can't really talk about his dead wife anymore, Bloor and Lombard tell everybody, hey, by the way, we went and looked for that boat. There's no boat, dude. There's no boat coming. We're just here. And General Mac flips out and he's like, we'll never leave. We'll never leave. It's peace. People are like, all right, dude. And then General Mac gets up and he's like, all right, I'm going to walk down and look at the ocean by myself. I'm obviously having kind of a hard time, okay? Sorry about that. I'll see you. So General Mac leaves the house, walks down. He needs some alone time staring at the ocean. This has been a lot for General Mac. He thought he was coming here to hang out with friends that he missed. A lot of things have happened, and he's had to think about some things he doesn't really like thinking about. He needs some alone time with the sea. All right. Next up, Vera Claythorne goes to talk with Emily Brent on the terrace because now they all know there's no boat. They can't leave. So Emily Brent's upstairs chilling. She's like knitting out on like a terrace, which is the second floor by the bedrooms looking out at the sea. So Vera Claythorne comes up and she's like, hey, what's up? I really want to leave. You know, it's a pretty big bummer. There's not a boat here. And Emily Brent, Krabby Mary Poppins, is like, I don't know. Things happen. You know, I'm still on that thing. I think that lady's guilt killed her. I don't feel bad about anything. I'm out on this terrace. I'm doing me, dude. And then Emily Brent explains to Vera that, like, oh, by the way, when that gramophone said I killed that girl, here's what happened there. I used to be, like, a nanny for, like, younger girls, you know, to, like, teach them how to, like, have good posture and, like, I don't know, read and, like, a woman's school thing that was, like, back in the day they would have those. Emily Brent, like, ran her own private one of those. So the name that the gramophone said that she killed, that was one of her students. Now, Emily Brent to Vera Claythorne is like, here's the thing. I did know that girl. She was working underneath me. Or, like, she was, like, learning from me. Here's the thing. I didn't know what kind of character she actually had, you know? She was out there gallivanting, doing things on the weekend, like you do. So I kicked her ass out. I kicked her out of school. I was like, you can't come here anymore. And then I guess she had problems. So then she went out and she jumped in a river and killed herself. And Vera Claythorne's listening to this and she's like, oh my God. Yeah, you killed that girl. And Emily Brent's like, I don't feel bad at all. I'm out on this terrace, dude. Things happen. It's just life. And at this point in time in the book, it notes that Vera is now really disgusted with Emily Brent as a person. All right. After that conversation, Armstrong and Lombard get together and they exchange notes. Armstrong is like, yo, Mr. and Mrs. Rogers actually may have killed that old lady from the gramophone record because I know about the heart condition that like her their old employer had. So the thing is, you got to take a certain medication every day to stay alive with the heart condition that the former employer of Mr. and Mrs. Rogers was suffering with, right? So here's the thing. It would be a really easy murder. It would be a murder of non-action. You just don't give her it for like a day and a half. That's it. You wouldn't even have to do anything. That's what Armstrong's telling Lombard. Lombard's like, oh, that's pretty interesting. How about that? And then Lombard shares with Armstrong that like, hey, I think what's going on here is that we've secretly been brought here by somebody to be punished because we couldn't actually be punished by the law for all of our murders. I already told you down in the main room, I definitely killed those 20 guys. That's all on me, dude. I did that. I skated out of there, dude. I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. Bye. I got 20 bodies on me, dude. But I can't be touched by the law. So what I think is happening here is that we've been brought to the house by somebody who's going by Mr. Owen to actually be punished for our crimes where the law can't actually touch us. That's just a personal theory I'm working on. That's what I got going on, Armstrong. What do you think? And Armstrong's like, well, all right, well, to add on to that, I think you're right. And I also think, do you know about the Sarge's Heroes army figures on the main dining table? Because if we look down there, there's only 8 of them left now. Now that Mrs. Rogers died in her sleep, somebody, whoever's killing people here, one, they're killing people. And two, they're doing the thing on the, they're taking soldiers away once they kill somebody. It has to do with, you have a death poem in your room where the fire escape thing should be? Dude, I think people, somebody is killing people according to that poem. And then after they kill them, they throw an army man out. Anyway, so I feel good about putting these pieces together. Lombard, what do you think? And then Lombard's like, well, as long as we're working together, how about a search party? You know, it's search party time. Here we go. So Lombard and Armstrong form a search party to check the island. Again, it's not a big island, but they're looking for somebody else, whoever's responsible for this. But it's only 2 dudes at this point in time. So Lombard is like, hey, let's go recruit Mr. Bloor. He's a retired cop. He could probably help us out with this. Good, strong dude. Just in case we run into somebody who's hiding, we could definitely take him in a fight. So Armstrong and Lombard recruit Bloor, and it's search party time, dude. Now, before search party time gets going, Lombard does confess to the doctor and Bloor, like, hey, what's up, guys? Happy to be on the search party with you. Just one thing real quick. I did bring a gun, dude. I don't know if it bothers you or not, but I got a revolver. I do have a gun on me. So don't be weird about it or anything. I'm telling you so you guys don't see it and start freaking out like I'm the murderer, but I got a gun on this island, dude. I feel great having it. I mean, technically, if you're in the search party, now all of you are like part owners of this gun and its capabilities, but you're really not, dude. I got a gun. Yeah, don't be weird. Anyway, let's check out, see what the hell's going on this island, huh? Lombard confesses to having a gun. Armstrong and Bloor are really on the fence about it, but there's not really shit they can do about it. So the 3 of them go around. They search the island. Doesn't take long. It's the size of a par 3. They find nothing. What they do find is General MacArthur having his alone time all sad by the ocean. And they try to be like, hey, man, what's going on? And General MacArthur's like, go away. You don't understand. So he still needs more time to kind of work out in his head what's going on. So the search party leaves him alone. Last place that the search party checks is that there's cliffs on like the northwest part of the island. Not really important. It's just where it's at, situated on this super tiny island. There are some cliffs. So the search party of Armstrong, Bloor, and Lombard get there, and they're like, well, we checked everywhere. If there is an extra person, there could be like a hidden cove, like in Castaway, where he like hit his own tooth out with an ice skate. There could be like a little cove down there. We should probably check this out. And so Lombard is like, look, I've done some mountaineering. You get bored. Go back up to the house and get a rope. And then when you come back, I'll use the rope and I'll just check out to make sure there's no castaway hiding spaces down there. Make sure there's not an extra person. And then we will have searched the entire island. Bloor's like, okay, cool. Bloor goes and gets the rope, which leaves Lombard and Armstrong alone with Lombard having a gun out by the cliffs on the northwest of the island. At this point in time in the book, I was like, yo, dude, Armstrong's about to get fucking shot. There's no way. This is going to be a death. Here we go. Doesn't happen. Bloor comes back with the rope, and Lombard tucks his revolver into his jeans, and he's like, all right, hold the rope, fellas. I'm going down. In the book, it says more than once that Lombard, in general, moves like a panther. So he panthers out, gets this rope, checks it out. Turns out there's no hidden Tom Hanks in these cliffs. No castaway hiding spots. Comes back up. They find nothing. Search party unsuccessful on the outside. And so the search party decides to go back inside, and we're gonna turn the house over. If there's nobody outside, then they got to be inside. There has to be somebody else out here moving Sarge's heroes, army men figures around, killing people, poisoning people. There's got to be something going on. So the search party makes its way back into the house. As they're going back into the house, Vera Claythorne walks on down to the beach to have a word with General MacArthur. You know, she knows he's having a hard time. You know, everybody's having a hard time. I'm going to go down there. I'm going to talk to him a little bit. So Vera goes down, says like, General Mac, how are you doing? And General Mac can't hold it together. Just after Vera says hi, General Mac is like, yo, I killed that guy. I can't stop thinking about it. General Mac tells Vera the whole story about the affair, World War One. His wife never knew. He don't know how anybody knows. He's cracking up down there. He's just like, I don't even know what the hell I'm doing. Again, I'm sorry for telling you all this, but I am going to need some more alone time with the ocean, okay? And Vera's like, yeah, well, I was just checking to make sure you're all right. Well, good to know. I got to go. Bye. All right, so search party back in the house. Lombard, Bloor, Armstrong, checking the house out. They're on the first floor. They're finding nothing. It's a big house, but it's not that big, and these three dudes are turning the whole thing over. Now, as they're downstairs, underneath Mrs. Rogers' room on the second floor, they hear faint footsteps upstairs. They're like, who the? Yo, somebody is in Mrs. Rogers' room, which would be a great place to be because nobody's checking the rooms where the dead bodies are. So if you were a person who was murdering people and you need to hide in this house, it'd be a pretty good strategy to hide where the dead bodies are. So the three of these dudes, Lombard, Armstrong, and Bloor, Lombard having a revolver, race upstairs to Mrs. Rogers' room, right? So they're outside the door. They're like, oh my God, we're going to get this dude. I can't wait. They bust into the room where Mrs. Rogers' dead body is, and Mr. Rogers is in there just kind of being bummed out and collecting some stuff, you know. So unfortunately, search party, pretty inconsiderate. Mr. Rogers just holds up like his wife's clothes and stuff, and he's like, I'm packing up. What's up, guys? I didn't know I was supposed to tell anybody I was in here. So the search party is like, hey, my bad on that. Keep doing it. I'm not going to offer you help. Obviously, we're busy doing our own tasks, but we totally understand. Sorry for busting in on you like that, man. Mr. Rogers is like, all right, well, I think it's a tough situation all around. I understand. So search party concludes after hurting Mr. Rogers' feelings and probably scaring him. They decide there's only 8 people on this island. There's no way we're going to find anybody else. We have no idea what the hell is going on. All right. After the search party decides to call it quits, Mr. Bloor, member of the search party, has like a baby mutiny on the other two members of the search party because he's pretty frustrated they haven't found anything. So Bloor looks at Armstrong and he's like, yo, did you overdose Mrs. Rogers? You're the last person to give her anything. Did you kill her with drugs? And Armstrong's like, no, dude, it's a mild sedative. I'm telling you. And then Bloor, still fired up, is like, yo, Lombard, why did you bring a gun, dude? Why do you have a gun? You know how much of a murderer that look maybe makes you look like? How am I supposed to trust you? How am I supposed to go to sleep, dude? Lombard's like, well, here's the thing. I got hired to come here, and my employer was like, I don't know what the hell is going to go on there. There might be some illegal shit. That's not my business. If you want to come prepared, that's fine with you. So look, that was the job description. I'm bringing a gun, dude. Nobody searched me. I'm a mercenary. The guy who hired me said some illegal shit might happen. I'm going to bring a gun, okay? And I told you about it when it was search party time. Okay, we've been hanging out all morning. Can you please stop coming at me? And Bloor's like, all right, I understand. Day two, lunch gong. They beat that giant gong in the foyer. It's time for everybody to have lunch. Shout out to Roger, still doing his job with his wife dead upstairs. He has prepared a delicious lunch of tinned fruits, cold ham, and cold tongue. Then, just to recap, now we have eight players left. We got search party of Philip Lombard, Mr. Bloor, Doc Armstrong. You also got turtle-looking judge from Ghostbusters 2, Wargrave. You got Vera Claythorne, who's dealing with some issues, definitely killed a kid. Also, really wishes she was living with this guy Hugo. Her plan totally didn't work, but she's trying to figure things out. You got Miss Emily Brent, who doesn't feel bad about much, and she's up there chilling on a terrace, Krabby Mary Poppins. You got Mr. Rogers, who's probably going through it, but working to stay busy, so maybe, you know, keep his mind off of things. But yeah, his wife's dead, and she's upstairs, but he's still making lunch a cold tongue. That's okay. And then we got General Mack out by the ocean. Number of people have come try to talk to him. He really just needs to be alone right now. He was not ready for that gramophone or all those memories. I feel like he doesn't have a whole lot of tools for emotional control. You know, so he's working on things, you know. But he's out by the ocean. But, you know, lunch gong, time to eat some cold tongue. What are you doing? So, everybody is in the room, seated, except for General MacArthur, who is still out by the ocean working it out. So, Vera, Lombard, Bloor, and Doc Armstrong are like, all right, so General MacArthur is still out by the ocean. Does anybody want to get him? Because he should eat some of this. I mean, at least the tinned fruit's not so bad. I'm skipping the cold ham and the tongue, but the fruit's not bad. We should probably go get him. So Doc Armstrong is like, all right, I'll just go get him, dude. It's fine. Lunch goes off. There's not a whole lot of conversation taking place because it's a couple dead bodies and nobody knows what the hell is going on. So not a whole lot of coffee talk going on here. But it's lunch, quick lunch. Mr. Rogers cleaning up the plates. And he looks out the front window and he sees somebody running back to the house. He sees Armstrong bust through the front door and Armstrong yells, General Mack is dead. Dun, dun, dun. Body number three, General Mack is out. He's done. Which stacks three bodies for us, leaving us with seven players at the end of part one of Agatha Christie's, and then there were none. Just to recap, our remaining players are Doc Armstrong, killed a lady on an operating table. Philip Lombard, mercenary who abandoned 20 dudes in battle. He doesn't even really feel bad about it, honestly, but he's still hanging out. Mr. Bloor, who arrested a guy who got sent to a labor camp, who died in a labor camp. He got a promotion out of it. He's a retired police officer, still physically strong with a mustache. You got Vera Claythorne. Complicated past on this one. Was in love with a dude named Hugo who lost his inheritance to a little kid named Cyril. She was the nanny of the little kid named Cyril. She was like, yo, you should go out swim on those rocks. She knew he couldn't swim to those rocks. She then tried to like, oh, I'm trying to save him. She wasn't really trying to save him. Cyril drowned. It was her fault. Hugo kind of knew about it and was like, I don't even want to hang out anymore. This is pretty weird. It feels weird. So she's heartbroken and also has the baggage of knowing that she pretty much killed a kid on her conscience. She's still here. Miss Emily Brent is still alive and kicking in the house. This is an older lady who hates gramophones and cushions on seats. She's pretty self-righteous. She doesn't feel bad about stuff. She got accused of killing a girl who was learning good posture and stuff from Emily Brent's private woman school, but then Emily Brent kicked her out. And then the girl was so beside herself that she jumped in a river and killed herself. That's the body on Emily Brent's conscience, but Emily Brent doesn't feel bad about it at all. And last up, hanging in, number seven, still around, Mr. Rogers. He lost his wife, who died in her sleep. Tim Curry from Clue, trying to hold it all together. Was it the best lunch you've ever eaten? No, but the guy came with a lunch of tinned fruit, cold ham, and tongue. You know, he's still working. He's still there. So that is the end of Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None, Part 1. Looking for Clues. I said that about as jumbled as you could. That is the end of Looking for Clues, Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None, Part 1. Nice. Anyway, so that's the story so far. We're going to drop another three bodies. If I chop it up into another two parts, make it a total of three parts. Or maybe run down the rest of the seven bodies. But I think it is going to end up being in three parts. But don't worry about it. All three parts are going to be made public. So we'll keep the topic completely public, guys. Thank you for listening to the show. I've really enjoyed doing this one. And again, this is going to be the most information as far as this topic goes. We had to establish characters. We had to establish setting. And then do some story. So, I mean, for the next couple of parts, we're not going to have to do those first two parts. It'll just be story and people dropping. So, RIP Anthony Morrison, or Tony Morrison, General Mack, and Mrs. Rogers. But, yeah, so we'll see. I'm still not going to read the end until I actually have to do the last part. So, guys, thanks for listening to the show, and I'll talk to you later on. All right, I'll see you.